The presidential motorcade had just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
The new norm. What is the new norm? Is it the new standard that we've set because we've basically bailed on our old standards? Do we get comfortable with the way things are now because through that race to the bottom, we've just accepted whatever is given to us? Do we just take things at face value and go, well, this is how it is now? I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. Before I get too far into other topics and other stories and do some heavy deep diving, I ran across a story that kind of caught me off guard through my research, and it's from the UK Daily Mail. But basically, it begs the question, what is the new normal? And do we have to accept the new normal? You know, like the mayor of London stated, we must learn to live with terrorism. What was it, Sadiq Khan, who said he believes the threat of terror attacks are part and parcel of living in a big city and encourage Londoners to be vigilant on combat dangers. Quote, it is a reality, I'm afraid, that London, New York, and other major cities around the world have got to be prepared for these sort of kind of things. Well, what if we had a standard that fought against it? You know, what if we took measures into our hands to go against this new norm? You know, when you look at people like the mayor of New York, Bill William Wilhelm Groundhog Crusher de Blasio, and Justin Flaccid Limp Trudeau in Canada, when we look at how they view Islamic immigration, or even just open borders in general, we have to think to ourselves, we are putting ourselves in this position. You know, we ask for this new normal, because Hungary and places like that have taken it upon themselves to keep their standard and not accept the new normal, and it's working out well with them. So in the UK Daily Mail, I ran across this interesting story. It goes like this. Bartenders, waiters, cleaners have been warned to ready themselves to fight terrorists in the event of an attack. In the lead up to New Year's Eve's celebrations, police are telling nightclubs, restaurants, shopping centers, sports grounds across, I think this is in Australia, their need to be trained to deal with armed terrorists. Police have warned front of the house staff across a range of industries to prepare for a probable terrorist attack. Bartenders, waiters, you know, they were seen waiting around and being told all of this information by the police over the arrest of a Somali-Australian alleged terrorist, Ali Khalif Shire. Senior Sergeant Rob Fleischer said frontline staff need to understand the plans in an event of an attack. A lot of times, it's not going to be us, the police, who are going to be dealing with the first 5 minutes. Of course, that is why we like that Second Amendment thing that Australia just did away with. Anyways, going on. The first 5 minutes is front of the house staff. Well, what are they going to be doing? Throwing cans of Campbell's soup? You know, because I've been through an active shooter training course where they basically said, well, you know, grab a can of soup. Yeah, that can of soup isn't really going to do anything against, you know, somebody proficient with a weapon, you know, flinging bullets at you at ungodly speeds. You know, so it's not going to be the first 5 minutes for the police to take care of it. It's going to be the front of the house staff. Inspector Peter Aitken said he warned, referring to ushers and people who take money at checkouts and cleaners and security, that they are going to be the ones to step up. There's a whole range, he said. Staff must be able to spot suspicious behavior and be ready to help patrons to safely, you know, help them through an attack. This comes in the wake of the arrest of the Somali-Australian alleged terrorist Ali Khalif Shire, who was accused of plotting an ISIS-inspired New Year's Eve attack. I mean, think about those resorts that we saw over the last year or so, where people were just hanging out, lounging by the beach, and the gunman just comes through and just starts spraying people down. I mean, this is the new norm, I guess. Ali Khalif Shire Ali was dramatically arrested and charged with trying to obtain a semi-automatic rifle to gun down revelers in Federation Square. So, you know, if you're a bartender and you're out there mixing up those Seagram 7 and 7s, you know, for some rude douchebag who's salivating and creeping out all your female customers while you're IDing the 17-year-old who's asking for the orange crush or sex on the beach, which is basically saying, hey, I'm underage. It's the calling card for the underage novice bar patron to order a sex on the beach, and you're trying to keep them from getting illegally loaded, you'll also have to extinguish Islamic Jihad. You know, make some fireball shooters, stop some active shooters. Why not? You know, when that pumped up drunk irrationally picks a fight with some innocent random customer, or maybe the pervy guy who is instigating a fight because he's hitting on somebody's wife and doesn't like the way it's turning out, you will also have to be extra vigilant to look out for the suicide bombings. You know, when you are in the middle of your New Year's Eve celebration and your festivities, and the DJ gets on the mic and says, hey, welcome to the club tonight. Thank you for all you showing up tonight. We're going to rock out with some great tunes. Tip your bartenders and waitresses and have a great New Year's Eve at the Viper Club. You're going to have to, over top of his babbling nonsense and the electronic dubstep music, you're going to have to listen out for that Allahu Akbar, you know, over the decibel busting music while you're delivering those wingdinger appetizers to table 205. I mean, this is the new norm. You realize now you're going to be the resort's wing of Department of Homeland Security at $2.15 an hour plus tips. And now this didn't specifically happen in America, but I want to put it through the lens of what could happen in America. I want to use Americanism as context so that you can fathom what this all means. I mean, we can really think the global disbursement of migrants. You know, they love to call them migrants. They're not illegal immigrants. They're not illegal aliens. They're just undocumented migrants. Migrants, people that just want to move about the globe without any paperwork whatsoever and just show up wherever. But hey, they might be ISIS. Who the hell knows? But see, we have to take that as the new normal. And we can think that flooding that happened, what is it, in August of 2015, where we just saw teams of people just streaming out of Syria, all male, you know, males and boys getting on boats, heading over to Europe, maybe heading down to Australia, New Zealand. You know, we have ISIS over there in the Philippines, which we've done shows on. We have ISIS in America. We have MS-13 in America. And in fact, a raid was conducted recently throughout America, a coordinated raid, where over some 200 some MS-13 gang members were, you know, basically scooped up. And out of those, maybe about 5 were actually citizens. Maybe about 7 actually legally found a way to come here. The rest completely illegal. And so when Trump and everybody screams, build the wall, which we're hoping is still going to happen, we're holding our breath on this freaking wall. Maybe it's going to be the solar wall. Maybe they're fitting it with solar panels and it's going to, you know, build its own energy. Maybe we can hook up a couple potato clocks to it and get a little time readout. You know, maybe we can even do that and put the national debt up there so we can just watch that ticker right there on our new solar wall. But if we do get a wall at some point, we have to enforce the immigration process beyond just the wall. The wall just keeps them out. I mean, they can tunnel. They can take a sub. I heard of a story where illegal immigrants had crafted their own freaking sub to go underwater. I mean, they will do anything. Okay, they're able to take a 1950, you know, Mustang, a chassis, and turn it into a freaking lifeboat coming out of Cuba. I mean, you've got issues like in Honduras with this uprising over an election that they didn't like. Who knows what's going to happen as that spills over from Central America and South America and all the unrest that's happening in Venezuela and what have you, when those people want to come to America alongside of the Syrian refugees and everybody from the Middle East that wants to suddenly, you know, set up shop in little safe zones like in, you know, Dearbornistan and make their little no-go zones of anti-assimilation. We have to take all this into effect and into account because we don't want to become the new normal of just allowing anything to go down to where you're, you know, checking out people at a Target and you got to make sure you have your sidearm under the register just in case you have to take out a potential ISIS-inspired douchebag on Black Friday You have to be mixing up, you know, gin and tonic, and you got to watch out for somebody going, Allahu Akbar, and gunning down all your swimming resort patrons. That is the new normal, and it seems to be for Australia, and we should not demand that to be the new normal here in America. Back in a moment.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
Welcome back. In the first segment, we were talking about illegal immigration and how those who are wanting to use that process for nefarious issues are exploiting it, and how we need to be better equipped with our immigration process. I mean, in Australia, we were just talking about how, you know, the police are basically saying, hey, you resorts, you know, bartenders, wait staff, point of sale cashiers, you're our first line of defense up against terrorist attacks by illegals. It's amazing. And so we have to think about that through the lens of what we're dealing with here in America. You know, the DACA program. Everybody talks about DACA. The DACA caca is what I like to call it, because it's a bunch of garbage, a bunch of crap. Heritage.org, they actually had a great breakdown of DACA. So we probably should look at what DACA's intentions were, what the intended use of the DACA program was being sold as, versus what it actually turned out to be. Now, DACA was providing amnesty to the beneficiaries of the Deferred Action for Children Arrivals program, and that's what it was called, the DACA program, as well as other illegal aliens brought to the U.S. as minors, is an action that is fundamentally flawed, just as the 1986 amnesty and the Immigration Reform and Controls Act was. DACA was the unilateral executive program implemented by President Barack Obama in June of 2012. Without legal authority or the approval of Congress. It was, as Attorney General Jeff Sessions said when he announced the six-month wind-down of the program on September 5th, 2017, he called it an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch. Now, although Congress has plenary authority under the Constitution to establish the rules regarding immigration, the president has only such authority as is delegated to him by Congress. So everything Obama did with the executive orders for DACA and DAPA, all unconstitutional because Congress provides those powers. Going back to the report, as the courts ruled in the federal lawsuit filed by 26 states against a similar program President Obama tried implementing in 2014, the DAPA program, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents, providing what amounts to administrative amnesty and access to government benefits, such as work authorizations, is beyond a president's constitutional and statutory authority. Federal immigration law flatly does not permit the reclassification of millions of illegal aliens as lawfully present and thereby make them newly eligible for a host of federal and state benefits, including work authorization. Now, the DACA program has constantly portrayed as being benefiting illegal aliens who were merely a few years old when their parents brought them into the U.S. and leaving them unable to speak the language of their native countries and ignorant of those countries' cultural norms. And so the reasoning is it would be a hardship to return them to countries where they were born. Barack Obama himself gave this rationale when he announced DACA, claiming that the recipients were, quote, Americans in their hearts and minds in every single way but one on paper. Wow, play into the heartstrings. They were brought to this country by their parents as infants and faced deportation to a country they know nothing about with a language they do not even speak. Now, the qualifications for DACA were illegal aliens were able to qualify for the two-year amnesty, which could be renewed as long as they came into the U.S. before their 16th birthday. They had continuously resided within the U.S. since January 15th of 27 was another requirement, and were under the age of 31 as of January 15, 2012, the date of original Department of Homeland Security memorandum on the DACA program was listed. 2014, as it was announced in the DAPA program, the Obama administration also attempted to change DACA by adjusting the original entry date from 2007 to January 1st, 2010, and to remove the upper age maximum of 31. This change was enjoined along with the DAPA program. Although DACA required continuous residence in the United States 5 years prior to the 2012 implementation date, Department of Homeland Security did not consider trips to the aliens' native countries as problematic. That's crazy. so long as those trips were brief, casual, and innocent. Yeah, those trips to the homeland to come back across the border. Maybe if we took five of those trips and then we went out to a pier and randomly found some weapon and, you know, accidentally discharged it and killed a young lady, maybe that would be considered innocent and brief and casual trips. That's what Kate Steinle was all about. But anyways, going back on to the report, DACA also required that beneficiaries enroll in school, graduate from high school, obtain a GED certificate, or receive honorable discharge from the military, have no conviction of a felony, significant misdemeanor, or three or more misdemeanors, and not pose a threat to national security or public safety. However, the high school education or its equivalent requirement was apparently routinely waived by the Obama administration as long as illegal aliens were enrolled in some kind of educational program. So you see, this is one of those things where we have to look at it and say, okay, they were basically harvesting new voters. I mean, they're gearing them up. You know, they're educating them. They're showing that they are these great upstanding citizens. And that's basically how it was framed. But the problem is what the reality of the actual DACA program was. From the Hill, the narrative surrounding the DACA program holds that it was put into place to protect kids and that they were innocently brought here with no fault of their own. You know, and it's also implied that applicants were mostly Hispanic and that these citizens of distressed republics a short distance away from the wealthy United States were violating immigration laws as being somehow understandable. You know, they want to come to the land of milk and honey because their land is so oppressive. From the outset, that narrative rang hollow. In a Washington Post column, they actually talk about how this is a public relations narrative. Quote, many of the DACA kids were not brought here as young. They entered the U.S. illegally as teenagers. And you remember back in 2010, back in the middle, it was 2010, I believe, when they were actually asking for new hires for Department of Homeland Security and for the ICE programs, because what would happen within 4 or 5 months later in May of 2010, the influx of people across the border that just magically appeared and they're shoving them off into these areas. They needed people to transport them, and they anticipated this influx by asking for, you know, new hires, putting out new applicants. So it's ridiculous. But anyways, going back to the Hill piece, A large number of DACA applicants weren't brought here at all. They crossed the border themselves. 2,000 individuals approved for DACA had their status terminated for criminal activity ranging from illegal alien smuggling and sexual assault. Fewer than 900 DACA recipients, or slightly more than 1/10 of the 1% of the total DACA population, actually joined the military. It goes on to say that the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services organization establishes that most of the DACA narratives are false. Particularly overblown are claims that deported DACA recipients would be inevitably strangers in a strange land. USCIS lists 149 countries of origin for DACA recipients. English is the national language of at least 26 of those countries. Those countries include United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland. A large number of applicants are from India, Hong Kong, the Philippines, where there are enormous English-speaking communities. Other statistics also undermine claims that the United States must, quote, take care of DACAs or condemn them to a life of isolation or poverty. At least 36 of the nations of origin listed by the USCIS are wealthy, democratic, and European. They include Austria, Denmark, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Sweden. Applicants also originate from at least 9 Asian countries with fully developed or rapidly developing economies, including South Korea, Japan, Singapore. A total of 360 nationals from Israel applied for DACA benefits. Israel is a developed nation with a thriving economy that accepts all returned citizens and provides free instruction in Hebrew to returnees and immigrants. In fact, many DACA applicants' birth countries are listed on the higher end of the Common Standard of Living Indexes, which means that DACA advocates are arguing that the United States has a moral obligation to undermine its own laws in order to avoid returning illegal aliens to countries whose citizens are considered to have a higher standard of living than many Americans. It's amazing. One wonders why it has never occurred to Congress that its primary obligation should be protecting native-born American kids from illegal aliens who compete with them on every entry-level job available and seats at colleges and universities. I mean, it's unbelievable when you get down to it. More than 1,000 DACA applications were accepted from Pakistani nationals despite concerns over growing anti-U.S. sentiment within the country and the Pakistani government's overt support for jihad terrorists. Because what's most disturbing about the data that the USCIS put out is that the number of DACA applicants that come from countries associated with terrorism or overtly anti-Americanism is huge. This is a cause for concern, given the lean and light vetting that the Obama administration switched to. At least 60 applicants were accepted from Iran, more than 2,000 from Venezuela, even though both nations are overtly hostile to the United States. Applicants were also accepted from Libya, Syria, Yemen, even though Obama administration placed travel restrictions on nationals from those countries, just like President Trump has done recently. Let's not forget that. Due to terrorism concerns. Based on the facts rather than the myth, it seems clear that individuals who applied for and received DACA were not oppressed. They weren't well-meaning, they weren't high achievers that the media and open borders lobbies portrayed them to be from the terrorist nations, but they were well-meaning high achievers from these well-to-do countries that they didn't even need to leave. As new amnesties loom on the legislative horizons and low standards for the DACA program should have every American citizen wondering what exactly will happen with amnesty if it is expanded to be the DREAM Act or similar legislation, should any of that pass. That's one of the issues we have to worry about here, is that we are going to receive a higher incident of terrorism because of the influx of anti-American and terrorist nations through these DACA vehicles, these conduits. And we need to be concerned that we don't want to turn into what is being what is occurring in Australia, where we have to have our front of the house staff and our point of sale cashiers thwart off terrorist attacks. Because even though a good chunk of the DACA recipients are actually well-to-do and coming from countries that are fine, they don't even need to come to America for the land of opportunity, it's being exploited by anti-American terrorists. And that should scare everybody, that the fact that the, you know, Congress and good parts of our government really don't care to keep the citizens' protection at the height of its concern. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
And I am confident that the Ethics Committee would agree. Nevertheless, today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate. I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
And there you go. Al Franken decides to resign from the Senate. And that's the thing we have to look at, is this is all something that has come out from the Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement that spawned us Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Now, it's funny how the DNC is framing this, because they're trying to use this as a way to show that they've got some moral backbone. You know, it's like, look at us. Yeah, we had people with sexual allegations in our party, but they're resigning. And we've had people online go, and they're doing it gracefully. Yeah, it's real graceful when you decided to, you know, when the allegations first came out, decided to double down and go, you know what, I'm just going to go home for Turkey Day and reflect. Just take a moment, you know, to reflect, but I'm going to get back to doing the work of the American people. You know, like John Conyers, I'm going to go ahead and step down. You know, my health is kind of bad. I'm not feeling so hot these days. And I'm going to turn this over to my son. How about we inherit, or why don't we pass down the throne of the Senate seat down to my son? Because that's how it works. You know, that, and that's gracefulness. Sounds to me like coercion. Sounds to me like Roy Moore's you know, poll numbers started going up. And the RNC decided, whoa, he looks like he's going to do okay. Let's go ahead and fund him, even though we pulled all of our money from him. And he was actually raising money on his own, doing quite well. Yeah, let's go ahead and back him. Then all of a sudden, the Democrats said, oh, this is our moment to look like we actually have morals. Let's go ahead and get Al Franken to resign. Never mind, since the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was getting BJs under the Resolute desk, you know, with his fleshy humidor and his big cigars, everybody was saying, oh, it's just sex, you know?
I got to get back to doing the work of the American people.
No, that's what it was for years. Every pundit said, it's nothing, it's just sex. Why are you bothered with their sex, with their sexual pursuits, you pervert Kenneth Starr? Now they want to turn around and act like they're the moral authority. And so they do this on the cusp of Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Yes, Time Magazine's Person of the Year was given out to the Silence Breakers. So it's Persons of the Year, their time. You know, the Me Too movement, the hashtag Me Too movement that brought down Harvey Weinstein, which was a good thing. And a lot of these allegations and a lot of the results of the Me Too movement are legitimate. So don't take what I'm saying as the wrong way. But you have to realize that there's more to it now that other interests are involved. The founder of the Me Too movement actually founded this years ago. It wasn't something that happened, you know, a few months ago. So keep in mind that the Me Too movement is now starting to be infiltrated and hijacked, just like every other movement. And what you do is when you have something you want to prop up, like Colin Kaepernick being your citizen of the year, even though he didn't vote like a good citizen would be, or Obama, I'm going to give you a Nobel Peace Prize just for being elected. Or Ronan Farrow for getting the Walter Cronkite Award as soon as he was hired. Ironically, he's the one that broke this story, and he worked for NBC, and NBC wouldn't take him on with the story, so he had to go peddle it elsewhere. You usually give accolades, you know, let's make Linda Sarsour the woman of the year, you know, and just to, so that people get legitimized for their activism. And you know, this is another movement that the left wants to weaponize, framing it as something innocent, providing vindication to those who are victimized. The Me Too movement is the feminist version of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I even made the assumption that I actually thought it was some, you know, closely connected to the Women's March, you know, the vagina hat parade, almost to the anniversary of the event. The same event where victimized women were worried about their rights while fighting for Palestine. That's right, Palestine, because that's about women's rights. I'm sure the women's rights movement is livid over Trump's recognition of the capital of Israel as Jerusalem because, you know, women's rights and all. And remember, the organizer of the event was Linda Sarsour, who called for the jihad against the White House. Same person who was on the anti-Semitism panel while continually making Jewish racial slurs on Twitter. I mean, this is from the women's convention that Time Magazine covered back in October. Nearly everyone at the women's convention had a story. One woman told a packed audience that she had been abducted and raped as a child, and her parents hadn't noticed. Another told a group of potential Emily's List candidates about how she escaped her abusive husband. A third described being told that she was too pretty for a corporate job. Because, you know, that's sexism right there. The attendees had gathered to discuss immigration, healthcare, voting rights, and racial justice. But the recent wave of allegations of sexual violence against women became the issue that united them all, exactly. Linda Sarsour was there, and she was one of the co-chairs of the Women's March, and she said, the conversation around sexual assault and violence against women, of course, puts some new energy into the movement. It also allows people to find courage, and when you find courage on an issue like sexual assault, you will find courage to talk about immigration. You will find courage to talk about poverty. So there it is. Has nothing to do with just sexual assault. It's the template. It's the same template. It's the play on the emotions and use a movement or a topic or a cause to vilify your enemy. It's like the Dreamers. Oh, who wants to break up families of those who are, you know, relatives of undocumented migrant parents who've lived here for years and take them and put them in another country that they don't even know? Well, that last segment, we just blew that argument away. Go back and listen to it. iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn app, Spreaker, iHeartRadio. It's all on the podcast. It's like the environmentalist movement. Do you really want dirty water, dirty air over climate change and global warming? No one wants that. This is actually used as a force, an anti-American force. Through the Dreamers, they can flood the voting rolls to back the Democrats and to give, you know, cheap labor to the rhinos and their K Street lobbyist. Through environmentalism, they get to hamstring our energy, resources through anti-American regulations to hamstring our superpoweredness. They outlawed nuclear energy while the president, progressive presidents in the past have aided and abetted North Korea and Iran with nuclear energy capabilities. So if they're that bad, why are we giving them to them, those countries, so that they can turn around and kickstart their nuclear arms races? If they're so detrimental to the environment, why would they allow other nations to utilize them? Why is China never demonized for their lack of environmental concern over their emissions and their impact? But remember Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, saying the world isn't safe if America's the only world superpower. She said, has there ever been a better example of an arrogance of power? We are becoming drunk with the idea that we are the world's only superpower and therefore can do whatever we want to whomever we want. That was our Secretary of State. So realize a lot of these movements are being hijacked by the left for other nefarious reasons. And we can refer to The Naked Communist, which was a document that Congressman Albert S. Herlong Jr. read into the Florida, or he was from Florida, he read into the congressional record back on January 10th, 1963, about the goals that the Communist Party had against America and how a lot of these movements seem to dovetail with it, like with the nuclear energy and nuclear weapon disarmament. Naked Communist number one, U.S. should accept coexistence as the only alternative to atomic war, which is also in a reference to nuclear energy, which is an offshoot of nuclear weapons research. Number two, U.S. should be willing to capitulate in preference to engaging in atomic war. Number three, develop the illusion that total disarmament by the U.S. would be a demonstration of moral strength. Where have you heard that before? But it also goes into Antifa and Black Lives Matter. I mean, who doesn't want to fight fascism? Who doesn't want to eradicate white supremacy? Naked Communist goal number 22, continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. An American communist cell was told to eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings and substituting shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. We haven't seen that, have we? How about their little argument of, well, you know, we got to do away with the Constitution. It's old and we need to progress towards a new socialist form of government. Naked Communist goal number 29, discredit the American Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step with modern needs, a hindrance to cooperation between nations on a worldwide basis. Number 30, discredit the American founding fathers, present them as selfish aristocrats who had no concern for the common man. Number 31, belittle all forms of American culture to discourage the teachings of American history on the grounds that it's only a minor part of the big picture. Give more emphasis to Russian history since communists have taken over. Number 32, support any socialist movement to give centralized control over any part of culture, education, social agencies, welfare programs, mental health clinics, etc. Remember, refuse fascism, the group that Antifa sides with promotes communism. Remember that Black Lives Matter is supported by a communist group like Freedom Road Socialist Organization. And remember that any movement can be hijacked by the left, even hashtag Me Too, to, quote, support any socialist movement to give centralized control over any part of culture, education, social agencies, welfare programs, mental health clinics, etc. Back in a second.
This is Adrian Slade.
The Adrian Slade Broadcast.
So in the last segment, we were talking about, you know, Me Too, the Me Too campaign and the Time Magazine Persons of the Year, the silence breakers and those who've been victimized by sexual abuse and those who may be utilizing that movement for something else. And we talked about Al Franken's resignation and how he took it as a way to take a parting shot at President Trump and Alabama Senator candidate Roy Moore. We need to talk about what was going on in Texas with the Texas state legislature, because that is some real Me Too stuff. And these representatives were Democrats in Austin, Texas. Check out this story. This is Lauren. It's a story about Lauren. That's not her real name, by the way. a Texas legislative intern. She was standing underneath the bright blue and red neon light of the Continental Club, a famed Austin bar frequented by schmoozing politicians, lobbyists, and reporters. That week in May 2013 was filled to the brim with end-of-session parties, and Lauren was with a group of other interns on South Congress when Democratic State Representative Boris Miles pulled up. Now, according to Lauren, Miles had leaned out of the carriage he was riding in, pulled out a large wad of money. He handed maybe $500, which is what they quoted as saying, to an intern, and then looked at Lauren. This comes from the Daily Beast. You know how you have that roll of hundreds that you see on TV? It was like that, Lauren told the Daily Beast. I said, "Hi, Representative, how are you?" Then he slowly looked me up and down, counted out more money, reached out his hand, and said, "Bitch, you want to F with me tonight?" I said, no, thank you, and physically stepped back, Lauren recalled. I didn't want to be rude to him. I remember his intern pacifying him and saying, "Yeah, it's time to go." Everyone was just shocked that he said that, and that he cussed at me, and that he was offering me money. It was outrageous, Lauren continued. I just remember thinking, I need to go, and I need not to be here anymore. Chris, another anonymous name, a Democratic state representative who asked not to be named out of fear for his personal safety, confirmed Lauren's contemporaneous account of her story to the Daily Beast. Chris is in the same party as Miles, represents a district geographically removed from Miles' district, and works in a different chamber and has never run against him. At some point at the night, I got a call or text message from Lauren, he recalled. She said Boris Miles was at the Continental Club and propositioned her. I didn't quite understand the whole scenario until later, but I knew that she was not comfortable and she was not good. Chris and the chief of staff told the Daily Beast that they received the call and then went and picked up Lauren from the Continental Club. In several interviews, all three of them said they spent the rest of the night drinking together in a group. And it goes on further to say, the chief of staff said, I remember we asked her whether she wanted us to do anything about it, but at the time she said, no, let's just get out of here. I'm not going to see him again. Sarah, another anonymous name, who worked with Lauren in Chris's office, told the Daily Beast that she was informed about the incident the following morning. Quote, I remember thinking at the time, why would you say something like that to a young woman who is literally doing nothing to you, Sarah said. I was surprised that it was that open. Like he did it in the public place. That kind of blew my mind, especially because he's a lawmaker. Yes, the fallibility of man with power. That's my own thing I just threw in there. It's not the sexual innuendo or just a guy seeing if you're up to something. It's far beyond that, Sarah continued. In my opinion, he was going out of his way to intimidate and victimize young women at the Capitol. Well, now, Miles has a bit of a history. Mr. Miles, including an incident that happened in 2008 when he was indicted on two counts of deadly conduct involving a night when he was accused of pulling a gun on a Texas Southern University regent and his wife in a lounge during a Rockets game. During the trial, the couple said that Miles waved the gun around, pointed at the woman, and put it to his own head. Quote, he said, I could blow your brains out. A woman named Kim Jackson testified, according to the Houston Chronicle. In the other episode, Miles allegedly crashed a party at the St. Regis Hotel, forcibly kissed a woman, and planted a Godfather-style kiss of death on the cheeks of a local businessman while brandishing his weapon. The man hosting the party pressed charges against Miles and allegedly said, you don't know what I'm capable of doing. So obviously Mr. Miles here has an issue with power. He's got an issue with thinking he is the BMOC. And, you know, sexual favors, waving and brandishing weapons, visible threats. You know, I'm above the law because I make the law. That's what we're dealing with here. In May of 2013, Chris's office and others in their part of the Capitol were hosting themed parties with food and alcohol. In his office, Lauren and Sarah did the organizing. Quote, at some point, a handful of members, including myself, went into another member's office, Chris said. And we were just having a conversation, just a normal conversation. Miles just kept fumbling in his suit pocket, and he would pull out his small handgun. It was like a nervous tick, Chris said. He'd take it out, look at it, put it back in his pocket. That was the end of the evening for me, and I went back into my office and told my staff that it was time to go home. Nothing good could happen there, he said. Chris is chief of staff, and Lauren both confirmed the incident, and that Chris came back into his office, ended the party due to fears over Miles' gun, and separate interviews to the Daily Beast. He said, quote, I remember my boss coming back and saying, yeah, Boris Miles is over there and has a gun out, said the chief of staff. The quick consensus was that we need to get the heck out of here. So this is what happens when you give power to an individual who is going to use it to their advantage. And this should be something the Me Too movement should be focused on. This should be something that the public should be focused on, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's entertainment industry, you know, music, television, whether it's lawmakers in D.C., whether it's a boss. Power corrupts absolutely. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, too. And when you have power on your side and the actual force of government force, which can do anything at once and has a mean to a forcible end, you know, a boss can just fire you. Yeah, that's a kind of a force, you know, because you can't make the money. You know, Weinstein can have you on the casting couch, you reject him, and he's like, okay, you'll never work here again. But government can come in with a gun. Government can take all your money through the taxing authority. Government can stifle a 501c3, c4 Tea Party organization from being organized. They can bust into a Gibson guitar plant and shut them down over the type of wood they're using through the EPA because, you know, we don't like your political views. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.